All right. Hi, everyone. My name is Rachel and I work for Torah in Motion. I'd like to wish all of our US attendees a happy 4th of July, and I welcome you all to today's special class on a synagogue revolution, the impact of independence on American Judaism with Rabbi Dr. Zev Elif. Today's class is sponsored in memory of Samuel Rosner Danziger, Simcha Ben Lieb, father of Jared Danziger and Jane Spiegel. Retired Lieutenant Colonel of the U.S. Army Reserve, a proud American as well as a proud Jew. Our speaker today, Rabbi Dr. Zev Elif, is president of Gratz College. He was previously chief academic officer of Hebrew Theological College and vice provost of Touro College, Illinois. A prolific scholar, he's the author or editor of 9 books and more than 50 scholarly articles in the fields of Jewish studies and American religion. His most recent book is called Authentically Orthodox: A Tradition-Bound Faith in American Life, published in 2020. Zev's research in American Jewish history has received numerous awards, including the American Jewish Historical Society's Wasserman Prize and the Rockefeller Award for Excellence by the American Jewish Press Association. He is also a 2-time finalist for the National Jewish Book Award, a member of the Academic Council of the American Jewish Historical Society, and one of the youngest faculty members promoted to full professor in Touro College's history. I'll post the source for today's talk in the chat, and I'd like to remind all of you to please keep yourselves muted if you are not actively sharing. And yeah, without further ado, I will now leave you to your speaker.
Rachel, thank you so much. And I suppose thank you to my mother for supplying the material for my bio. I'm going to share my screen up. If you give me that superpower.
Oh, sorry, are you not the host?
I am not the host.
One moment. Sorry. I just need 2 minutes to sort that. I
Sure.
haven't done that.
Give it a second.
I'm going to send you a couple of instructions that you need to do to claim host status.
You'll send me a couple of instructions to do what?
To claim your host status, there's just a little code that you need to enter.
Okay, is that you come? That's coming through the chat.
Yep.
Okay. Okay, I'm going to do them. I'm going to clean the host status.
Perfect, you're the
Wow.
host now.
All right.
You should be able to share your screen.
Very good. Thanks for the quick audible. Okay. And happy July 4th to everybody in North America. Or Israel, or wherever else it is. A synagogue revolution, the impact of independence on American Judaism. So, or I want to first discuss, it's the first time I've ever done this, what we're not going to be addressing, which is this image over here. This image I found a long, long time ago in the bowels of the American Jewish Archives, in the papers of a wonderful author of American Jewish Life, Anita Libman Lebason, wrote a very charming, one of the most robust books called A Pilgrim People in American Jewish Life. And in 1954, because of the earlier success of that monograph, the Bureau of Jewish Education, in honor of the tercentenary, that is a very fancy word to say the 300th anniversary of Jewish life in North America. The first Jews disembark on what was then New Amsterdam in 1654, about 23 off of the St. Catherine. 1954, there's much celebration over the 300th anniversary of Jewish life on the continent. And a slide deck, this is before PowerPoint, quite obviously, a series of slides produced by the Bureau of Education, Jewish Education. And one of the slides is right here, and the caption that Levison offers is the following: Puritan Code of Laws. Particularly did the Puritans of England show their love of Hebrew and the Bible. In 1640, they published a psalm book using Hebrew type for the first time in North America. In 1634, a code of laws submitted to the Massachusetts General Court was called Draft of the Model of Moses, his judicials. In 1658, Plymouth adopted the Jewish code as a model for their laws. And so went the series of progressions of law in North America, that if the Pilgrims had founded their code of law in Plymouth Meeting on the Hebrew Bible, on the Talmud, so it stands to reason that as we move forward from Jonathan Edwards to Thomas Jefferson to James Madison, maybe as far into it as Abraham Lincoln, America was forged on the basis of Judaism. And for eons, shiurim lectures, sermons delivered around July 4th made the argument that the United States was cut from a Jewish cloth. I'm not here to debunk that, but I think the more interesting argument is not the impact that Judaism had on the United States, but the impact the United States has had on American Judaism. My wonderful teacher, Jonathan Sarna, Brandeis University, has made the case that if you take a look at synagogue constitutions, they're not exactly the most interesting materials more often than not, but people spend a lot of time furnishing bylaws and a set of postulates, a set of principles that form their entities, that form their organizations. In American Jewish life, in the colonial period and the early republic, there was no more central organization than the shul, than the synagogue. So even if they hadn't looked at the concept, even if I don't, just like today, I don't have any belief that school trustees, that board meetings are beginning or calling the roll call and then looking at the Constitution to see what exactly are the parameters of their business that evening. I don't think that at all. But the Constitution, the bylaws, the principles of a shul, they're really thoughtful documents. And in this case, mostly men spent a lot of time thinking about how to frame those rules and regulations. So the very first synagogue constitution we have is Sherith Israel, what's now on the Upper West Side, Spanish Portuguese Synagogue. The shul was founded, probably a little bit controversial, in the early 18th century. You go onto the shul's website, they'll claim that their origin begins as soon as those 23 Jews disembarked from the St. Catherine in 1654. That's likely not the case. There's no evidence of a synagogue building until the very beginning of the 18th century. And in 1728, around the time in which they have this building over here, this is an artist rendering, the folks at Sherith Israel, the trustees, the Parnas, the president and his leadership, form the following: in the name of the blessed God, Amen, whereas on or about the year 1706, 5466, certain wholesome rules and restrictions have been made by the then elders of our holy congregation to preserve peace, tranquility, and good government amongst them, and those after them, and as they have been neglected to be put in due force for some time past, we now meet with common consent and resolve to revive the same with some amendments and additions, which are as follows. So what's the gist of it? They were aware that some 20 years prior, the leadership of this congregation had formed a constitution, a set of bylaws. But nobody knew where it was. We certainly don't have it any longer. And so they met 20 years later to say, you know what? We are in America. We do have this organization that we call Sherith Israel. Well, we need a function with a set, with something. So firstly, they shall be elected as Parnas, that's how they spelled it, and two Chatanim, those are deputies, which shall likewise serve as assistants for ye good government of our holy congregation. So already there is this idea that a school should form a government, not to say that they're going to rebel, that these are Whigs fighting against the Tories, but in the very beginning of the 18th century, there was already the sense that a shul should function as a sub-community that should govern the Jewish community, a sub-community within the larger British colonies. And who gets to make that decision? The elders. The elders formed the very first constitution in 1706. And then at the beginning of two decades later, it is the Parnas and the two Chatanim who are charged with the power to adjudicate, to set in motion a set of bylaws for how the congregation will function. Now, in those days, that was a big deal. What do I mean? Maybe it'll be funny to you. Shuls had the ability to fine members. If you sat in somebody else's seat, you had to rent your own seat if you wanted to be a member of the congregation. Membership wasn't just a due that you paid, but you actually rented space. You had real estate in the congregation. And they could fine you. If you were caught, if you spoke, we know this, if you were rowdy during worship, you could be fined. What was the penalty if you didn't pay a fine? Well, because the cemetery was controlled by the congregation, because access to kosher food, because even though we don't have an ordained rabbi in the United States until 1840, there were still synagogue functionaries. And if you wanted to have access to the social security of American Jewish life, you had to be a member in good standing of your colonial synagogue. And this time, this was the only colonial synagogue in the United States in the early 18th century. Well, that's not true. There were a few others. And so they wielded tremendous power, and it was governed by just one, two, or three people. Usually, this part hasn't changed, the wealthiest of the community. I want to take a look at how the Constitution, the bylaws change over a period of time. So we don't have the earliest constitution of 1706. We just looked at 1728, and now we're fast forwarding another 30 years or so to 1761. Now, this is not an original evening service, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. This is a facsimile. This was the very first machzor produced in North America. You see that publication place is New York. Good. So please use the chat. If you'd like, I'll make sure I can read. You can even unmute yourself. I'm very happy to make this as conversational as possible. So it's a really good question in the chat. To what degree was the wielding of power based on what happened in the community in Amsterdam? It's a really good question. So we have, first of all, there were no rabbis. It was a very lay-led community in North America. And we see that access to Jewish artifacts came from Amsterdam. So the junta, which is the lay-led, we call it today the executive committee of a synagogue, would submit their questions or requests to their brothers and sisters in Amsterdam, or if not in Amsterdam, in England, or in Kingston, or in Johannesburg. Jews typically in this period lived around port cities. They did this because Jews had a strong social network. If you traded oranges or sugar or people, Jews were involved in the African-American slave trade to some degree or another. In order to maximize your revenue, you would send your cousin, brother, nephew, a male-dominated economy, to another port, and you would create a network. That network of economy also was a religious network, so that if you needed to borrow a Sefer Torah, you would use the same instruments, the same levels of communication that you traded, that you functioned economically and socially for that matter, also religiously. So the Jews in colonial America were deeply indebted to the religious and lay leadership of the Jews in Amsterdam and in other European and British port cities. So they were very beholden to it, and therefore it was altogether revolutionary, it's a good word to use, that New York's Jews should produce this prayer book in the 1760s. And the idea of making it, of creating a more intense infrastructure, that's part of my argument this morning. As American Jews become more independent from Jews elsewhere in Europe or the other side, we'll call it the other hemisphere, all of a sudden they create new documents to demonstrate their independence. And as we'll see, they draw from the sense of American Republic, American democracy. It's a great question. So take a look in 1761, very same year that the very first Machzor is published in America, in New York. On the 20th day of Shvat, 5521, corresponds to 1761, the Yechidim, interesting language, right? Before we saw the elders, the Yechidim, the individuals of the Kehila Kedosha, were assembled by plurality of votes elected. That capital E is not a typo. It's very German English. And many German words for emphasis, nouns especially, are capitalized. By plurality of votes elected the following five persons. Who are they? Jacob Franks, Isaac Gomez, Meyer Myers, Haman Levy, all the leaders of the Jewish community in New York, and Samson Simpson, assistant to the Parnassim, which office they accepted. They are invited to leadership, the Yechidim, the individuals, the members of Sheret Israel, and with the authority given them by the said Yechidim. Let's compare for a second. Here in 1728, we see where's the power vested in Sheret Israel? In the elders. And in, firstly, there shall be elected a Parnas, now it's elected, into Chatanim to form a government, but that's a very close circle. You don't get the real impression that it's really democratic. Here, by 1761, now, we're not up to 1776 yet, but the spirit of democracy is already overwhelming the continent and the colonies, and it's making an impression in the way that shuls are governing themselves. In conjunction with the Parnassim, they are to collect and form such laws and rules as may be necessary for the benefit and tranquility of the congregation. They're worrying about this entity, not that they are vested with the responsibility of establishing a government, but it's that they are summoned by the congregation to revise and renew a set of laws, for which purpose they are to meet on the first day of every month. And now there is a rhythm, there is an obligation of the leadership. They are to meet on the first day of every month, or when required by the Parnassim, Sabbath and festivals accepted. So you get this impression already 30 years later that the source of power and what is summoning these this congregation and its leaders into ratcheting up their sense of belonging and sense of responsibility is being what's washing over them is a spirit of democracy. Well, the next time Sheriff Israel meets to establish constitution and bylaws, it's 1790 years after. They are now no longer living in the British colonies. They are now in 1790 in the age of Washington. They are in the United States. And here is these five formed the board of directors. They didn't use such a term, Ruth. It's a good question that I would call the executive committee of the congregation. Now, here you have Gershom Mendesatius, and a very important but non-ordained minister. He grows up in the congregation. He is the very first religious leader or professional in the United States, although he's not ordained. And it's important that he emerges as a young boy through congregation Sheriff Israel. We the members, so 1790, where do you think they got this from? We the members of the Kehila Kedosha Sheriff Israel meet this day by legal summons from the Junta, Executive Committee, published in the synagogue two Sabbath days successively, due by these present in the most solemn manner, in the presence of the Almighty, so God is appearing now, and of each other, agree to form such rules to serve for and be considered as a constitution, and to accede to such other institution, rules, and regulations as may be conducted to the general good of this congregation. We the members, we the people, this is 1790. They are drawing from the rhetoric of the constitution. Whereas in free states, this is not a Jewish state inside of New York. This is a congregation. But when they have to form a new constitution, it's very Jeffersonian to want to form a new constitution every couple of decades. They're using the language of the American Constitution. Whereas in free states, all power originates and is derived from the people. This is the point made again by Dr. Sarna, who always retain every right necessary for their well-being individually. So the framing, the philosophy of forming a synagogue is drawn from the Constitution, and it's the philosophy of rule of law in the United States. And for the better ascertaining those rights with more precision and explicitly frequently form a declaration or bill of those rights. 79, this is the Bill of Rights. It's just been accepted. In like manner, the individuals of every society in such state are entitled to and retain their several rights, which ought to be preserved inviolate. Therefore, we the professors, they don't mean scholars, they mean people who profess of the divine laws, members of this holy congregation of Sheriff Israel in the city of New York, interesting, they're translating Kehila Kedosha into holy congregation, conceive it our duty, they are duty bound to make this declaration. They're drawing from both the Constitution and Jefferson's Declaration of Independence of our rights and privileges. First, of Jews in general, that every free person professing the Jewish religion and who lives according to its holy precepts is entitled to worship the God of Israel in the synagogue and by purchase or gift to have a seat therein. Everybody has the right to pay for a place to pray. But again, it's the idea that every and by person, they mean man, that won't happen until much later, until the end of the century, where Philadelphia's mikveh Israel, I believe, is the first to offer a sense of membership to women. And to be, but that, of course, was ahead of women's suffrage, and to be treated in all respects as a brother, and as such, a subject of every fraternal duty. It's a good question. were there Jews in bondage? Are there non-free people? Not to my knowledge, Ellen. Oh, Ellen, how are you? It's a good question, but I think it's more that they want to, if Sherith Israel in New York, a very cosmopolitan city, if when the leadership sits down in 1790 to once again, 30 years, 29 years after their last constitution, and they are ready to reframe it because it's been outmoded, they are going to use language that they know from Jefferson. So even if there are, the implication is, are there non-free Jewish persons? To them, it doesn't matter. They are here, they are drawing from a language which resonates. And that is part of the, what, you know, Gordon Wood, as he won two Pulitzer Prizes for the same essential argument, of the spirit and the culture of independence. And that's critical for them. And it's spreading. So a year earlier, in Richmond, Virginia, congregation Beth Shalom, again, there are no more than 9 congregations that form in the colonial period, all across very limited East Coast United States. We, the subscribers of the Israelite religion, residents in this place, desirous of promoting. So they have a preamble again. We did not see much of a preamble in the earlier documents. Desirous of promoting the divine worship, which by the blessing of God has been transmitted by our ancestors, have this day agreed to form ourselves into a society for the better effecting the said laudable purpose to be known and distinguished in Israel by the name of Beth Shalom. They too in Virginia, makes sense in Virginia, to be drawing from the language of the United States Constitution. It is necessary that in all societies that certain rules and regulations be made for the government for the same as tend well to the proper decorum in a place dedicated to the worship of the Almighty God. A reminder, once again, God is introduced into the Constitution. It's not about the leadership. And in fact, we've seen John Butler and others have made the argument that contrary to what we might think, that America is a place in which religion goes to die, that's actually not the case, is that the colonial America, the early republic, from the first Great Awakening in the very beginning of the 18th century and the second Great Awakening in the 1820s, 1830s, and 1840s, America is growing in their religious fervor. So that we're seeing God being introduced into the synagogue constitution is, once again, it's fitting in to the ethos of the American social spirit. It is necessary that in all societies that certain rules and regulations be made for the government for the same as tend to the proper decorum and place dedicated to the worship of the Almighty God, peace and friendship among the same. We do therefore agree that the following rules be adopted. We, the subscribers, the power is vested in the people, God, but the people, continued in force until a majority of the congregation proposed to alter or amend the same. They're anticipating amendments. Again, it's 1789 when the Bill of Rights are signed and approved and ratified. Every free man residing in the city, again, you see this language of free man, for the term of 3 months, of the age of 21 years, and who congregates with us, shall be a yachid, an individual of the Kehila, and entitled to every right and privilege of the same. That's a good question. I ask the question, is it a Spanish-Portuguese congregation or Ashkenaz of Spanish-Portuguese initially? We'll get to the very first Ashkenaz congregation. That's you're anticipating my punchline.
Do you think maybe the free man concept is because of to differentiate themselves from the black slave?
Yeah, so I would. It's a good
because
point.
Jews already were discriminated against. I mean, in a sense, you
absolutely.
Know,
it's a good point. It's a good point. Peter Stuyvesant, already in the 1650s, who was the governor of New Amsterdam. Although he was a bigot, he treated everybody pretty poorly, not just the Jews. It doesn't excuse when he tried to prevent the emergence of a synagogue in the early 1650s. That's a good point, Nikki. Let me actually, that and Ellen's point, I think you're right. I think that free men was to indicate that Jews, it was betokening Jews' social status. In some sense, I think, you know what? I have to think about it more, but I'm willing to say aloud that free men was the equivalent of making the claim that Jews are white.
Right? I don't want to make something about the word chotanim. Does it have a history that's similar to that of chatan Torah and chatan Bereshit?
Yes. Same idea. Chatan Bereshit. So nowadays, when we normally raffle off or we give as a kibud, an honor, readings on Simchat Torah, we talk about Simchat. So we call it Chatan Bereshit and Chatan Torah. And now we think about it. Well, chatan means a groom, the idea it's a summons. The groom is being summoned to the wedding canopy and appointed as such. And he similarly, so it's actually Chatan Torah and Chatan Bereshit historically in the modern period. And that kibud is actually less to do with the analogy, the impression of a wedding and being married to the Torah. It has more to do with the idea that you're an appointee. Correct. It's interesting how different words take on meaning. And we pour different meaning into words over a period of time. It's a very good point. But I think, go back to the point, I think free men is likely a signal. I don't know who besides the executive committee and members are taking a look at this, these synagogue constitutions, but at least to themselves, it is meant to offer a jolt of self-confidence that Jews are free men, Jews are of a social status, which, rises above, certainly, slaves. Shelley asks about my wonderful friend, Laura Arnold Liebman, wrote Once We Were Slaves, a fabulous book, right there, in my library, about non-free Jews in various Caribbean islands. Yes, so Professor Liebman has, she is the leading scholar of the Atlantic, I would say. There are other people doing it as well. She's actually inspired more scholarship on it. She's a fabulous, fabulous scholar. And the idea of mixed race Jews, particularly in the Caribbean, is here you talk about mixed race or whether they could belong to a shul. You're absolutely correct. And even though at the end of some of her books, she brings that history to New York, the Caribbean Jewish experience and the role of slaves and the agency that slaves had in the Caribbean were very different than in the United States. And so that history is local to the Atlantic, to the Caribbean and to Central America, although it does make an impression and does have a certain foothold in the Americas. You're absolutely right.
And there was the thing about that was when, these people went to, they had to go to certain islands to convert. You couldn't do it in all islands. And then Sarah right. Brandon went to New York and not New York. She went to Bevis Marks in London.
London.
Her father brought her out, gave her a big dowry. Right. And she was considered white there. And
correct.
She could get married in Bevis Marks and her father.
But not in the Caribbean. Exactly right. And so what that tells you.
The thing was that her father arranged a marriage with an Ashkenazi Jew, and he couldn't get married in Bevis Marks if he wasn't marrying a Sephardic Jew.
Correct.
Race in whether you're Ashkenazi or Sephardi, it's all intertwined and it's crazy.
It is crazy. It's very or interesting, but you're absolutely right. The status of race changes throughout the Atlantic. And so you see the Jewish community has to adapt to social and political context. And you're absolutely right. Let's move to where I am in Philadelphia, in Mikveh Israel. In 1824, again, these documents are being produced at particular moments. So Mikveh Israel has just moved in to a new synagogue building. We saw that in 1761, a new constitution came about where there were other changes, namely the very first prayer book in North America. So what's triggering these constitutions is something new, is innovation. We, again, here you have echoes of the Constitution. We, whose names are hereto subscribed, electors of the Hebrew congregation of the city of Philadelphia and citizens of the state of Pennsylvania, do hereby publish and declare that we have formed ourselves into a body corporate by the name, style, and title of Kahal Kadosh Mikveh Israel under the articles and conditions following to wit. And again, you see that language in the early republic. They want to align themselves with a certain way of rule and of architecting a framework in that same American political spirit. Right. Another question. So maybe even there are already questions coming in privately and to everybody about this idea of, it's interesting, you know, it's fabulous. You always, when you review texts and you do it the chavruta, when you do it with other people, you pick up on other texts and it's fascinating. I claim absolutely no dominant knowledge or inference or intuition on this idea of free men, and it's open to interpretation. That's why history is so wonderful. Take a look. Now we're going to Charleston in Kahal Kadosh Beth Elohim, in 1820, another Spanish-Portuguese synagogue. Now, this synagogue would not be formed until 1839 after a terrible fire. Take a look. I'm zeroing in not on the preamble, but two items within their constitution. Again, furnished in 1820, very beginning of the early republic. No person or persons shall be sanctioned to combine for the purpose of erecting any other synagogue or for uniting in any other unlawful minion within 5 miles of Charleston, nor shall any person or persons under the jurisdiction of this congregation be permitted under any pretense whatever to aid, join, or assist at any such unlawful minion or combination. That was Rule 8. Rule 9, there shall be one congregational burial ground only, wherein all the deceased members of the congregation shall be interred. Where did the graphics come from? That's a really good question. Much of this is from my collection of images, and I should have made clear from the from the American Jewish Archives. It's a wonderful repository. Some are from the Sheretz Israel website. Wonderful images. Let's pause though for here. Maybe here's an opportunity. I'll even stop share for a moment. If I stop share, then we're not going to see the text. But what do you make out of these? Anyone?
In what you just posted, it sounds to, again, like Shades of Amsterdam, where I read a novel about life in Jewish life in Amsterdam, which I believe is fact-based, that the Jews in Amsterdam became kind of like the inverse of the Inquisition. The Inquisition was trying to make sure that people didn't practice Judaism, and the powers that be in Amsterdam, you know, had this iron fist grip on people to make sure that they were towing the line on halakha as they saw it, and became just as corrupt as the Inquisition.
Interesting. Ashali, I see you have your hand up.
I'm wondering if there is a similar phenomenon among the churches in America, or yes, whether this is just a Jewish phenomenon.
No, absolutely. I could have easily have shown you a number of early churches that absorb that spirit of Americanism. Absolutely. It's a good point. Yes. And Judaism doesn't exist in isolation. All religious groups, political, social groups are absorbing this same spirit.
This is a Jewish. This is a Jewish concept that you don't.
Except, Nikki, it's a good point. Of a sagat gvul, of encroaching on one's territory. Except that the generally the Gemara and Bava Batra happens to say that the exception is the synagogue.
But with a synagogue with a limited membership, you could destroy a congregation if you pull enough, just enough away that they cannot support a congregation anymore. There weren't that many Jews.
I think they genuinely identified with their environment. And it wasn't fake at all. It was intentional. They felt they were in America and they were in a democracy and they were going to act accordingly so long as it went along with the synagogue and everything around the synagogue.
Okay. Anyone else? So let me maybe put that image up again.
One question. Was this written in English or was this written in Hebrew or Ladino English. Or Portuguese? No,
this is in English. This is in English. So, much of the worship was still in a Spanish. And we'll see in a moment that gets some people particularly tickled. But these bylaws are all in English. This is the trouble with democracy and revolution. Once you revolt from the establishment, well, what happens if in a generation or two, somebody tries to revolt against you? So here they are. This is that tenuous balancing exercise in which the congregation is open to votes and to a spirit of republicanism. And at the same time, we are the framework. The Charleston congregation is the end and of all things Jewish community. It is the synagogue community. And it is unlawful, absolutely unlawful to establish a competing congregation. Whether it's masig gvul, you are encroaching, you are making our institution untenable because we cannot support two congregations. Maybe that is the argument. It's more of an argument out of economics, or it's one out of politics. Either way, the government, and we saw that's how the earlier constitutions referred to the synagogue as a government for the Jewish community. It is illegal. Punishable by excommunication. Nobody wants to be prohibited from being buried in a Jewish cemetery. So I provided rule 9 that you have to be in good standing in order to be buried into a congregation. Jews are very particular about that. And that's the challenge in the early republic, that as congregations are framing themselves along the lines of this democratized form of polity and government, all of a sudden they open themselves up to competition and to other competing communities. So take a look in 1825. This is a cutout of Isaac Harvey. In his time, very well-known playwright and journalist. We actually have an inventory of his library. People's libraries say much about them. Maybe not anymore because you can find so much online. But before 1994, what you had in your library really accounted for your sense of cultural literacy to some extent or another. We have Harvey's library inventory. He didn't have much in the way of Jewish or Hebrew texts, which says something about his capacities to lead a Jewish community and what his interests are, particularly. In 1825, he is the leader of about 40 young people who write to the Charleston congregation, one over here. They do this in 1824. And they write, we'd like more English. We'd like more decorum in our services. None of us speak Spanish anymore. Stop it, please, with the Spanish. We could do Hebrew. And if you're going to do other languages, please offer English. And the leaders of the congregation in Charleston, it's important, it's a Southern, right, where you still have a sense of authority, compared to, say, New York and Northern states. The leaders of the Charleston Jewish community say, absolutely not. We're not, we are the community, and we will not change how we do things. We are indebted to tradition. So Harvey and his group forms the, in those days, is actually the largest Jewish community, even larger than New York, just by a little bit. That would change when Harvey would leave. The economy in Charleston was declining anyway since the Battle of the War of 1812. Charleston's port was seized by the British, which had a deleterious effect on the economy in Charleston. And so people were moving out anyway. Here you have the very first instance of Reform Society of Israelites in Charleston in 1825. Not a rabbinic movement, a lay-led young people movement in the United States. Any Israelite whatsoever who makes a donation or leaves a legacy of not less than $50, today the equivalent of $1,000 or so, for the benefit of the society shall receive every mark of respect, have the right of burial, and be entitled to every religious attention to which members are entitled. It's just one example that I pulled out of the very first Reform community. They had their own prayer book. They had their own sense of community. And they were one of the very first two synagogue breakaways in American Jewish life. There's a long history of shul breakaways, as you can imagine, in American Jewish history. And they are the first one. And one of their articles makes clear that as long as you pay your dues, you are a member in good standing. And that is the result of this. Now, what's happening concurrent, exactly, also in 1825, is a letter that is submitted by, again, young people within Sherith Israel. We're going back to New York in 1825. They write a letter to the Parnas, to the executive committee, the trustees of Sherith Israel, of Spanish Portuguese Synagogue in New York, 1825, as, again, the lay people are thinking about moving into a new synagogue building. All this is happening when there are fissures and there's change happening in these communities. We are deputed a committee from a meeting of Israelites held at Washington Hall to announce to you their intentions to erect a new synagogue in this city. It is our duty, and we must cheerfully comply with it, to acquaint you with the motives which has induced us to take this step. We have a large portion of our brethren who have been educated in the German and Polish minhag. The very first Jews in colonial America were descended from conversos, or people who were otherwise expelled from Portugal or Spain in 1492 and 1497. They came from the Spanish Portuguese Rite. That's why those first Jews came to in 1654 to New Amsterdam, only 23 of them. The reason why they fled, they were in Brazil. Well, Brazil was just invaded. Amsterdam, Dutch Brazil was just invaded by the Portuguese in 1653. And the writing on the wall suggested those Jews, and the Inquisition was moving to the Western Hemisphere. So that's the Spanish Portuguese Jews. But now, almost 200 years later, the new migrants to the New World were from Southern Germany. And they didn't want to pray in the Sephardic Rite. They wanted an Ashkenaz prayer, Siddur. And they had, previous to this letter, asked kindly, could we borrow the Sifrei Torah and have a Polish or German directed service? The leaders of Sherith Israel said, Absolutely not. Same as what we saw in Charleston. They weren't asking to truncate the service to change it. Language in English. They weren't motivated by necessarily by reform proclivity. Harvey was. Harvey invoked the reform, the Enlightenment and reform in Germany, in his famous letter, which he authors and lectures on the first anniversary in November 1825 in Charleston. He even sends copies and receives kind notes of response from Thomas Jefferson and John C. Calhoun. Here they're motivated by the desire to widen the tent of Sheretz Israel and offer an Ashkenaz service.
Is the use of the word Israelites significant? When did the Israelites become Jews in America?
It's a really good question. And if you take a look at the recent issue of Hartman's sources, I do a little bit of the work on this. On much later, 1877, there's an instance of anti-Semitism in the Grand Union Hotel in Saratoga Springs. That's a really good question. The word Jew does not really become popular until the Eastern European migration in the late 19th century. I had shown you that very first image of the that rendering from the 20th century of the Puritans. The Puritans saw themselves as the new Israelites and Jews as the custodians of the Bible. And for their own self-confidence, used language which could be heard with respect from their other American neighbors. And so they preferred, we are Hebrews, we are Israelites. And that's why you see the newspapers are called the Hebrew Leader in New York, the American Israelite, or first just the Israelite in Cincinnati. It's why Reform Judaism founds institutions called Hebrew Union College in the Union of American Hebrew Congregations. So you see words like Hebrew and Israelite appearing much more often. And eventually it becomes an indication of about stratification of class within American Jewish life. Eastern Europeans, those people, whether they're already in America or they're referring to them in Eastern Europe, those are Jews. We are Israelites. We're part of the early American and American Jewish establishment. So yes, Israelite is very important in this period. So we want to pray with the German and Polish Minhag, who find it difficult to accustom themselves to what is familiarly called the Portuguese Minhag. In consequence of their early impressions and habits, it is also proper to state that the increase of our brethren is so great that, and in all probability, will much greater in a few years than accommodations, particularly on holidays, cannot be afforded to all. The American Jewish community is growing. By the Revolution, there were no more than 1,000 Jews, probably the same number, maybe 2,000 by 1800. By 1820, there were 20,000, so it had grown by 10 times. And by 1850, and they're right, there'd be 150,000 Jews in the United States. And so they're anticipating growth, and the dominant group are not comfortable or familiar with the Spanish Rite, the Sephardic Minhag. Again, the great increase of New York and the distant situation of the shul render it necessary to have a new place of worship in a more convenient situation for those residing uptown, not very far uptown. We're not talking about the Upper West Side here. These reasons we respectfully trust will be satisfactory to your honorable board. We're breaking away! And will at once show our intention is not capriciously to withdraw ourselves from the ancient and respectable congregation of Sheretz Israel, which God may prosper, but is urged by motives of necessity. They are justifying the creation of a new congregation called B'nai Jeshurun, BJ, also on the Upper West Side, now a conservative synagogue. And they formed this new shul in 1825. The undersigned, this is actually earlier, but still good to read, Now that you have that perspective, the undersigned on behalf of themselves and a number of their brethren actuated with religious motives respectfully request the use of the place of worship of the Sfarim. So this is the letter that I was referring to. It is merely our desire to say the prayers at an earlier hour. They want to create a Hashkama minion. And that's what's, I apologize for flipping it.
But the this word is the shul is an Ashkenazi word.
Correct. So you can tell exactly where they're coming from. They're coming from southern Germany. And they're using the idea of, they call it Yehudim or Yehidim. Their language is very Polish. So you can tell that they're from Central Europe and they've got a certain Polish dialect. Therefore, it is earnestly requested the trustees will promote or undertake. And they think that they're going to get a congregation within their congregation. So, and here is B'nai Jesher. In 1826, whereas it hath pleased the God of our forefathers. So here is the final instance of a constitution. Our forefathers to gather some of his dispersed people in the city of New York who are taught and used to apply to him and his merciful bounty and to praise his holy name according to the rites of the German and Polish Jews. We deserve our own nusach, our own way of worshiping. And whereas the wise and republican laws of this country are based upon universal toleration, we have the right to break away. What, again, I've invoked him a lot, rightfully so. We're moving from a synagogue community to a community of synagogues. And that's the trouble with revolution. If I can do it, somebody else can revolt against me. Wise and republican law of this country are based upon universal toleration, giving to every citizen and sojourner the right to worship according to the dictate of his conscience. And whereas also the mode of worship in the established synagogue of our beloved brethren are baking their critique into their constitution, brethren share Israel in this city is not in accordance with the rights and customs of the said German and Polish Jews. We need a place of our own. Therefore, we, the undersigned, bind ourselves under the name Congregation B'nai Jeshurun to use our best exertions to support the synagogue in Elm Street, they call it uptown, it's still downtown New York, and usages of the German and Polish Jews to be the same as far as practicable without departing from the form and custom now in use by this congregation. We're trying to use the form. Not like what's happening in Charleston, not like what's happening in Germany. And that is the beginning of this history of the synagogue breakaway. So you see, what's happened in American Jewish life is being inspired by that spirit of American democracy that is ushered in with July 4th, 1776, maybe 1787, with the Constitution. But one, any way you look at it, while Jews have no doubt, and there's an argument to be made, have made an impression on American life, it can equally, if not more so, be understood that America has made an indelible impression on Jewish life in the United States. Well, thank you so much. I see that we have a couple of minutes. I was given strict orders. I'll stay on if anybody has any questions.
Yeah,
but I'm so glad. Hi. So glad to spend some time with you. Yes, Irene.
Hello. I'm from England, and because Bevis Marks was mentioned, not yes. that I'm Sephardi, but I'm an honorary Sephardi, and I'm very friendly with Rabbi Mark Angel, who was at Shaarit Yisrael, and his son. I just want to say something. First of all, happy Independence Day if you're American yourself and not Canadian. I don't want to get into a minefield. And I'm only first generation. My parents are from Poland, so I don't bear you any grudges. However, I should point out that there was a very good program on Queen Victoria. I don't know whether it was exported to America with lovely music and or I don't know, in Canada. And it was very obvious that even early in her reign in the 1830s, there was less racial sort of prejudice than other types of prejudice. And this was based on fact. And in 1833, before she was queen, when it was her uncle, William IV, there was a bill passed in Parliament by the Buxton family, who I'm friendly with their descendants, to stop the slave trade. And without getting into a fight with you on Independence Day, I think we have great prejudices in this country. I mean, America, Jews have done much better in America generally than in UK. That's an understatement. Okay. However, on the question of colour, I think it's been slightly different. And the other snobberies which show themselves in what the lady said about Bevis Marks that came on. Yes. That they were more worried about the Ashkenazi business. And that's to do with the history. Although we have the same Sephardim and then Germans and then Poles, like in America, same year, because of the church here, which wasn't so much of a problem in America at all, and the fact you were a revolutionary country against all the worst problems in England, you know, I can quite understand, even when I was young, my father was one of the only people who said, actually, the Sephardim are superior to us. Look at their culture. And I got into Sephardi studies. So I don't know what it is, because I'm just first generation.
I mean, I think you're onto something very important. You're absolutely right that even in the time of the Civil War, the Archduke of Canterbury and Rabbi Samson Fowell Hirsch are in agreement. He being in Frankfurt, the Archduke obviously being in England, that the Civil War just shows how backward socially the United States is. They are the last country to have figured out that slavery was evil. They are both in agreement of it. And Hirsch, who prior to the Civil War encouraged Jews to migrate to the United States, Rabbi Hirsch is convinced by the Civil War that America is an irreligious, backward country and has used his publication called Yeshurun to encourage Jews to stay away from the godless United States. And so you're absolutely
Do you mean Hirsch of Germany? Do you mean Rabbi
Samson Rav Hirsch? Yes.
You're joking. I didn't know that. I was not saying that America was a terrible place.
No, I'm not, neither am I.
You know,
my point is that
I'm just trying to say, in many ways now, the UK is still hidebound because it had an empire, lost it, and didn't know what to do with itself. Whereas American Jews, I mean, I've been doing a lot of stuff with American Jews. I'm absolutely amazed at your amount of knowledge of Judaism, and even people who are not religious culturally and everything, things like Torah in Motion and things I've done with California. What I'm trying to say is that the snobbery we've got in this country does exist, and it's terrible. There's a lot of anti-Judaism, for instance, and it's getting worse. But it seems to me from things like with Victoria, which I didn't know, and knowing the Buxton family, just how long they fought. It wasn't so much against America, because they started the whole thing with Liverpool, where I came from, you know, with the slave trade going through Liverpool and the cotton and all that, because it's so damp in the Northwest where I live. So I'm just saying that lady was very upset, who was a Canadian, I think, to do with Bevis Marks, which, by the way, is cracking up, and there's a better Sephardi shul now in London. But the fact is that did exist when I was a child, and I'm not as ancient as the people you've been talking about. I didn't understand it. And my dad, you know, was thought for himself, and he said Sephardim are amazing. And I was not surprised I got involved in Sephardi studies. And I'm friendly with Rabbi Angel, who really is a lovely person, like his name. I don't know if you know him. Yeah, but and his son, very nice people. So thank you for your lovely talk, which I'm going to
thank you. I think, and I know to hear that camaraderie on the other side of the pond. I think all of us Americans are pretty piqued by both your accent and your erudition. Thank you so much.
I'm from Manchester. It's like being from Detroit. It's not like being from London. You know, we're like Detroit or Chicago.
There any other like Detroiters? Everybody's entitled to their opinion.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, maybe a couple more. I mean, that
Rabbi.
When you are listing the organizations that use Hebrew in their names, don't forget the YMHA.
Right, already that's founded in the 1870s, right? The Young Men's Hebrew Association, Young Women's Hebrew Association. It was still, you're absolutely right. The list goes on really until the end of the 19th century. You do not find it. The one of the very first is the Jewish Theological Seminary, founded in 1886, is probably the marquee flagship now of the conservative movement. Then they called themselves Enlightened Orthodox, but really to offer immigrants rabbinical training. And the fact that it was an immigrant institution, they won't call themselves that today, really bespeaks just the change of terminologies. But you're absolutely right. It doesn't happen until the very end of the 19th century.
Rabbi, there's a couple of things. The French threaded it slightly differently when they called themselves Juif Yisraelit, so they use both terms.
Mm.
But we have a problem of racism by diminished expectations, because you might say that America was the last country at that time to give up slavery, but we know that slavery as slavery exists today in the third world, a lot of Muslim countries. So it's not gone. It actually exists as institutions today, and nobody says anything because we have lower expectations for certain communities in the world. The other thing about the breakaway in the U.S., in Europe, communities were breaking away all the time. So this is just a natural thing of communities, whether they're in an American milieu or a European milieu.
Hirsch, I mentioned before in this, in the 1850s, was the first one to sue. It was complicated in Europe because you paid your taxes through the Jewish community. So it was actually much harder to withdraw from the established Jewish community. It's interesting. What I'm drawing from in the crisis of faith is Mark Knoll, wonderful scholar, now emeritus at Notre Dame and at Wheaton. The Civil War is a theological crisis. Remember, it's Lincoln who anticipates this. We read in his second inaugural, we read the same Bible. The crisis is that people are reading the same text and are coming out with different outcomes, North and South. And people across elsewhere outside the United States are reading it and saying, boy, oh boy, do they have a problem. And but I don't mean to somehow diminish social crises that, you're absolutely right, exist to our present day. Okay, maybe two more questions. And then everybody has to get to their mitzvah of hot dogs and watermelon. And maybe some fireworks and a parade.
Thank you. This has been wonderful.
Sure, anytime. All right, thank you all. Happy 4th to those who celebrate, I guess.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
My pleasure.
So interesting.
Thanks for joining. Bye-bye. Mm-hmm.